All right, well, I might be really going out on a limb here, but I'm going to put it out there that sex is one of the best things that you can do as a human being. I know you're all thinking this conference has been pretty good, but I reckon that sex tops it. But as with everything under capitalism, for many of us, what should be a source of pleasure and fulfillment too often becomes a source of anguish and misery. And especially for those of us whose sexual desires do not fit in with the heterosexual model that is everywhere taken for granted as normal and natural in our society, or who don't identify with the gender roles that accord with that model, this is particularly the case. And it's reflected in the fact that same-sex attracted young people are 6 times more likely to kill themselves than their heterosexual counterparts. They're disproportionately affected by violence and subject to violent attacks, and disproportionately affected by depression, homelessness, and negative self-image. Socialists want to fight to end this inhuman state of affairs. The fight for socialism is a fight for a world where people are free and encouraged to, in a consensual manner, express their sexuality in whatever way they see fit, with whoever they like, and however many people they like, wherever they like, within some reason, and as often as they want. And so the fight for socialism is a fight for a world where people can do this without the pressure to conform to any particular model and without fear of any economic or social consequences or repercussions for doing so. But before we can even begin to fight for this state of affairs, we need some analysis of where sexual oppression comes from in the first place. Is it just straight people trying to impose their preferences on everyone else? Is it human nature to be homophobic? Is it a question of ignorance that needs to be met with a rigorous educational campaign? Or is it something more sinister at work? And I want to argue that sexual oppression is bound up with the capitalist system. Something is much sinister is at work. It's the capitalist system. And sexual oppression is part of the way in which the vast majority are oppressed and exploited by a minority, and that the fight for sexual liberation is therefore inseparable from the fight to overthrow the capitalist system in its entirety. So to begin with, what is capitalism? Capitalism is a system based on competition by those who control the wealth to accumulate more so as to avoid going out of business and to outdo their competitors. And the wealth that they compete to generate is created through bosses hiring workers to produce God knows what, all manner of things, and paying workers less than the value of what of the commodities that they produce at work. And this leaves the bosses with a whole lot more money than what they had to pay out to the workers in wages in the first place. And this is where profits come from. So workers are exploited by bosses. They're paid less than the value of what they produce every day at work. And in order for workers to accept this very unequal and unfair state of affairs, they have to be oppressed. That is, they have to be made to accept the authority of the boss, the legitimate, supposedly, authority of the boss, and their subordinate place within the scheme of things. It's no good, from the boss's point of view, if every time workers wake up in the morning and think, I don't feel like going to work and producing fluffy dice or whatever it is, I'd rather go bird watching or roller skating or roll around in jam, whatever. They have to feel as though they have no choice but to put those dreams and desires aside and do what society dictates. They have to go to work, they have to do what they're told, they have to produce value that's going to be controlled by a boss. So basically, workers have to accept that forces beyond their control will dictate their lives, and that their interests and desires have to be subordinated to that, and to the demands of society. And when we say to the demands of society, we of course mean the demands of the capitalist class who benefit from the organisation of society. And so this stomping out of spirit that the capitalist class has to do to the working class to get them to cooperate with their system doesn't just occur in working life. It doesn't just occur when you walk into the office or the factory, but by necessity it permeates every area of life. Because again, if workers were free in one area of life, then they'd be much less inclined to accept the authority of the capitalist class in others. And the other important reason why sexuality has to be oppressed under capitalism is that the capitalist class has a very important vested interest in what workers do when they're not at work. So the capitalist class has an interest in how workers conduct their private lives. Because it's the work that's done outside the workplace that actually produces the most important commodity in the capitalist system, and that's labour power. Because it's only by the bosses buying workers' ability to work that they can make profits at all. And so they don't leave the maintenance and the reproduction of this centrally important commodity to chance. Actually, they have an extremely important interest in making sure that workers' sexuality is moulded and subordinated to the demands of capital. So the way in which sexuality has historically and continues to be oppressed and controlled under capitalism is through the institution of the nuclear family. And so the nuclear family of a heterosexual monogamous couple with between 2 and 3 children living in a self-contained house, pets maybe optional, is promoted as the natural way to live and relate to each other. It's the way God intended us all to relate to each other and many others like him. And the ideas and assumptions that flow from the family are some of the most taken for granted and widely accepted of all those that justify the capitalist system, and even by many who profess to be its sworn opponents. And so I'm sure we'll all identify with this, that almost universally, the first question anybody asks when a new person arrives in the world is it a boy or a girl? In our society, biological sex is seen to be a, if not the, central defining feature of someone's identity and the determinant of how that new person should be treated. It affects what kind of present you might buy, what colour that present's likely to be, how babies are handled, how they are spoken to, and what activities they are encouraged and discouraged to pursue throughout their lives. And the point of all this unrelenting socialisation is to prepare people for the roles that they will be expected to take up or that they're supposed to aspire to later in life. And those roles accord with the nuclear family model. And in particular, it's designed to prepare women for their roles as the carers of husbands, of children, and the elderly within the family unit. And so that involves heterosexuality and the gender roles, where women are born to care for people, that caring for children, the elderly, and whatever else have to be accepted not as the thankless imposition they often are, but as fulfilling and natural and the key to satisfaction in life. And so all this conditioning and socialisation underpins the key functions of the family in relation to capitalist production. And that is the fact that emotional and physical care, child rearing and socialisation, housework, hygiene, nutrition, care for the elderly and sick is done in the home in private. It means that the funding and provision of these services is not demanded of the state or the bosses. And they are in no way or very rarely seen as a collective social responsibility, as I would argue they should be. And who benefits from this state of affairs is the bosses. It means they are guaranteed a supply of healthy workers at the minimal possible cost to themselves. And furthermore, the structures of the nuclear family, because it relies on unpaid work done by women, it undermines the value of women's paid work, which again, a double bonus for the capitalists, provides them with a pool of cheap labour, women's labour, which they can use in the workplace and in production. So the family is essential to channeling sexuality through the official channels, but it's not just about repressing or oppressing sexuality, but it also plays a key function in oppressing the working class as a whole, because the family is a key medium through which workers are convinced to accept their exploitation. The family promotes the values of capitalism by socialising children and preparing them to accept the status quo. They learn to accept and deal with hierarchical organisation from very, very early on in life. Children learn obedience and respect for authority from having to be constantly subordinated and having no economic or social independence from their parents. And for the parents, it plays an important role as well, that having at least some degree of control over their children and their home helps to compensate for the fact that they have no control outside of the home and in the workplace. The family also creates a pressure on workers to keep their heads down at work. Because families are often partly or solely dependent on a male worker's income, any action that might jeopardise that worker's job or income, such as joining a union or going on strike, carries with it a risk not just for the individual worker, but for the whole family who's financially dependent on them as well. And this is obviously a very useful deterrent to industrial action on the part of workers from the boss's point of view. The family also helps to maintain the stability and cohesion of capitalist production by giving a certain permanency and stability to society. If every couple of years or so people's relationships broke up and they moved around, they had to reorganise who looked after kids and where they lived, etc., etc., this would be very disruptive from the point of view of the bosses, who want to be guaranteed workers turn up year after year, decade after decade, to work to produce value for them. And so they want to promote the idea that people should form long-term, or hopefully for life, monogamous heterosexual relationships, or at least aspire to this and feel like they've failed if they don't meet up to it. Also, the family ensures that workers spend decades being responsible for children. And that, again, means that workers are more likely to have to stay in one place. They have a vested interest in trying to keep the job they have and maintain a regular income because they need to look after their children. And this is, again, this is in no way particularly desirable from the point of view of workers. But the people for whom, you know, without question reap the benefits is the bosses who, as I said, depend on this reliable and stable workforce that is ready to come back each day to be exploited. And the family also, under capitalism, is an important unit of consumption as well as playing a part in reproducing the workforce. Because people are organised, atomised in individual homes, it creates a much higher demand per head for things like cars, white goods and other paraphernalia you have around a house than if we lived in a society that was more communally run and where resources were more socialised. So in addition to playing an important role in production, in reproducing the workforce, the family is also an important unit of consumption that creates a special market that the capitalists can again use to make profits. And so the family is absolutely integrated into capitalist production. The sort of prevailing ideology of capitalism is that, you know, there's the workplace, there's the economics of society, and then there's family life in the home, which is voluntary and caring, and these things are two worlds and very different spheres of life. But again, like most ideology that justifies capitalism, it's about obscuring the truth and obscuring the reality of how society operates. So seeing the thoroughly integrated role that the family plays in capitalist production and consumption, in forcing the mass of workers to accept their exploitation and accept the capitalist status quo, is absolutely essential. And it highlights that in order to win sexual liberation, it's not enough to just do away with the family or the ideas that justify it, but that we need to challenge both the whole capitalist system and mode of production as well as the family, that these two things are thoroughly integrated and part of the same system. So the flip side of actively promoting and enforcing the nuclear family is that society has to disparage any type of sexual behaviour or living arrangements that conflict with the mainstream heterosexual model. So engaging in same-sex sexual activity was deemed to be a psychiatric disorder up until 1975 by the American Psychiatric Association. Legal discrimination has taken various forms, including the outlawing of sex between men up until the 1970s and in Tasmania right up until 1997, and the age of consent remains unequal. Same-sex relationships have not historically been recognised for the purposes of bereavement and carer's leave, inheritance rights, hospital visitation rights, parental leave, adoption, IVF, and tax concessions. And of course, gay marriage is banned or has recently been banned here and in much of the world. So, but it's not just legal and formal discrimination and oppression. In the media and pop culture, it's still far from common to see gay characters or themes. And in the rare instances where there are gay characters, they're usually typecast and treated as different by virtue of being gay. So whether they're outsiders come to lead the local characters astray, such as in Home and Away's recent lesbian storyline, or they're in movies that are specifically about oppression, such as Brokeback Mountain or Boys Don't Cry, where the gay characters are sort of these tragic victims, or they're defined and obsessed with their sexuality in a way that verges on parody, like shows such as Queer as Folk or The L Word. It rarely is being gay presented as natural or unremarkable, and characters created where their non-heterosexuality is just incidental to their lives and not the central defining feature, whether it be positive or disparaging. It's still deemed worthy of special mention. It's not accepted as normal, like characters that live on one or other side of Ramsey Street. And almost, and of course, almost everywhere, nuclear families are still presented as the normal and unremarkable way to live. And this is the case even though the frequency of households made up of mum, dad, and 2.3 kids is declining in Australia, because the ideology that justifies the family is still widely accepted, the key functions of the family also tend to, by and large, be upheld. So even if they don't live in the narrow nuclear family structure, people still feel responsible for seeing to the well-being of and financially supporting their children or their elderly parents, even if they don't actually live with them. And they still try to find some idealised monogamous relationship that it should endure forever, and often feel that they've failed or missed out on something if they divorce, if they leave their children, or they don't have children at all. And Neighbours gives us an example of this. I don't know, there may be some poor depraved souls here that don't watch Neighbours, but for those of us who do, the storyline about Declan and Bridget's baby, they're like 12 or something, and Bridget's having a baby, and her boyfriend Declan, he really wants her to have the baby. There's all kinds of problems with that. Obviously, there's no excuse that Declan has no say over it, but leave that aside. Declan wants her to have the baby because Declan himself was brought up by a single mother, and Declan's dream in life is to be the father to some child that he never had himself. And even though by Erinsborough standards, Declan's been brought up perfectly fine by Rebecca, a single parent, he still feels as though he missed out on something, and he wants to compensate with that with his own child. So that's an example of how the ideology of the family can still mean that people aspire to it even if they don't actually live in it. It's not just because people don't live in it doesn't mean they think that that's equally legitimate. But of course, there has been some room for alternatives to the nuclear family, especially there's been some space opened up since the gay liberation movement. So the fact that gay marriage has been legalised in some places clearly undermines the sort of strict model of what the family should consist of. But it's important to see that this kind of gradual flexibility occurs within very strict limits. Gay marriage has not been legalised in some places because governments want to promote greater sexual freedom or anything of the sort, but because they hope that by incorporating gay relationships into the general sort of family structure, they see this as the most effective way to preserve the family and maintain the privatisation of care, which is so central to the family. And so they're happy to tolerate the occasional same-sex couple bringing up children, so long as it's maintained, so long as the basic oppression is maintained, that people are personally and privately responsible for all the work of caring and etc. So this highlights that we need to fight for more than just same-sex relationships being absorbed into the oppressive structures of capitalism. It's important to fight for things like gay marriage because it's about demanding equal rights and combating homophobia in whatever way it emerges. But it's also important to see why, in and of itself, these sorts of demands are not going to be able to bring about liberation. So that's the family. And the family is the historical basis and ongoing of homophobia and sexual oppression in our society. But it's no longer the only way in which it's promulgated. Once homophobia is established as a prejudice and gay people established as a social category, it can take on a life of its own in ways that are not so much about trying to force people into the nuclear family, so much as they're about generally trying to divide people, divide the working class, and scapegoating particular groups. So an example of this might be controversies about gay men dealing with children, working in the childcare industry, or being primary school teachers, or sex ed in schools taking up same-sex sex themes, or explaining to kids about same-sex sex. That it's useful from the point of view of the capitalist class Because insofar as people think that the main scourge on society is what's going on in, you know, the moral values of sex education in schools, as long as people think this is the main problem with society, then it clearly takes the spotlight off the bosses and governments that are actually the ones that are responsible for making people's lives a misery, that are the ones who spend billions paying to bomb people in Iraq and Afghanistan while health and education services deteriorate, and who oppose every pay rise you may ever ask for. So it divides workers, so these ideas can be used to divide workers and undermine the sort of class consciousness that can start to lead a fight back, give workers a sense of their own power to challenge not just sexual oppression, but capitalism itself. The existence of homophobia also is important from the point of view of the capitalist class in that it makes a whole layer, and who knows how big this layer is, because it's absolutely inconceivable that more people don't experience same-sex sexual attraction than actually act on it because of how homophobic our society is. So this layer of people feel that can be made to feel because of the existence of homophobia that there's something wrong with them, that the misery and alienation they feel in their lives is because there's something wrong with them, that they don't fit into the way they're meant to be or the way society tells them they're meant to be, instead of thinking there's something wrong with the society that makes me feel this way. And this serves to make people feel less confident to demand their rights in, you know, every sphere of life. And it's not just, you know, you don't just see this phenomenon with homophobia, you see with immigrants and racism. So often if particular immigrant groups don't fit in, they feel like, well, it's their fault, they're not fitting in somehow or other, when actually the question to be asking is, why is this society so racist that I'm, you know, not being accepted? But the existence of these ideas that blame, you know, people say, you know, certain behaviours, certain whatever, where you come from, this is a problem, focuses people's disillusionment with society back on themselves and away from the people who are really to blame. And, of course, this clearly helps to maintain the status quo. And insofar as it does that, it props up the system and the rule of the capitalist class, and it is in no way in the interests of workers. And so all this has important implications for how we can most effectively resist sexual oppression, because the experience of growing up in a homophobic society tends to make people feel isolated, forces them to hide their sexuality, and generally undermines their confidence and sense of identity. So challenging homophobia has to involve loud public displays of confidence, solidarity, and pride that demand recognition of same-sex relationships and sexuality, and that openly challenge prejudice through shows of collective strength. And this can go much further than some of the solutions that are often put forward of individualised counselling or people getting the individual confidence to come out or education programs, which, you know, often are put forward as a solution. And it's been the sort of action, getting out on the streets, uniting, you know, big public displays of determination, that has changed, has brought about the enormous change in social attitudes and thinking, and some rollback of the discrimination towards sexuality over the last 40 years. Because it's worth remembering how little visibility there was of same-sex relationships even in the late 1960s. And it's been extremely important that people have got out on the street and fought for the reforms that have been brought about over the last 40 years. These struggles have made a huge difference to the experience of life for gay men and lesbians, and has shown that straight people can be one to supporting gay rights, that attitudes about sexuality can be changed, and the homophobic governments and institutions can be forced to retreat. But as we've discussed, the gay liberation movement has brought about more visibility and acceptance, that we have, you know, gay themes on both Neighbours and Home and Away simultaneously, but it hasn't brought about liberation. For that to happen, these struggles need to have as their ultimate goal the fight for a completely new society, one that is not based on exploitation or oppression of any sort. And there need to be struggles that aim to link up the gripes of gay men and lesbians with capitalism, with all the other people that have gripes and groups that have gripes with capitalism, against exploitation and oppression in all its forms, in order to overthrow the entire system. Because if this doesn't happen, these struggles are going to be incorporated into the system and reproduce all the rotten values and ideas that justify oppression in the first place. And again, we see that with the legacy of the gay liberation movement, that The increased visibility of gay characters on TV and all that reinforces is important, but it also at the same time reinforces that this is different. It's not mainstream, and it leads then to the creation of new stereotypes and lifestyles that gays and lesbians are meant to aspire to, and this does not constitute liberation. And worse than that, not only about aspiring to a particular lifestyle or to fulfill a particular stereotype, and that you can usually only do that if you can afford it anyway, but even worse than that, for a layer within the queer community, they actually develop an interest in the propagation of homophobia. Because so far as they're able to make money from this kind of ghettoisation and these new stereotypes that can be generated through the incorporation of the gay liberation movement, to the extent that they can make money out of this, they also have an interest in maintaining the marginalisation. And this highlights that the oppressed do not all have an interest in liberation simply by virtue of experiencing oppression. It also depends, crucially, on how they fit into the broader structure and the broader economic organisation of society and capitalism, whether they're exploited or they're exploiters. So to win real sexual liberation, then, we need to look to all those who have an interest in challenging and ultimately overthrowing every last idea and institution that justifies the status quo. And we have to look to the people that have the real power to bring this about, which is the working class, as the group in society that's the vast majority and that makes up the majority of all the oppressed groups and that has an interest in fighting in a unified way to bring down the system. So we need the sorts of revolutionary upheavals that create a radical break with everyday life, that bring into question every idea and assumption that the system rests on, and it gives the mass of the oppressed and exploited the confidence to act to demand their right to live and relate to each other however they like.